Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart and a guy who still has some hair on his head, unlike today's guest. Today's guest has been shaving for years, and then he said, what if someone created a better way to do it, a better way to shave your head? Sounds easy, right? Well, actually, no, it doesn't sound easy. It sounds really tough, and it was tough. And I invited him here to talk about how he turned that idea into a business. His name is Todd Green. He is the founder of Headblade, which makes shaving razors that, actually, they're right over his shoulder, right there, you can see. It makes shaving your head really easy, and the designs of them are so beautiful that his razor is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Actually went to check on that. I said, that's unbelievable. I went to their site, and yeah, it's true. All right.
I've hacked to their site. That's how good I am.
What do you say about me that I'm the kind of person who you told me that that's true? Wikipedia told me that's true, and I said, wait, something doesn't seem right. Let's go double check.
Yeah, it's true. Well, you can only add so much to Wikipedia before they start closing it down. So,
well, I did my research. It came out okay. The other thing that I researched was your revenue. And I saw that 2007, there was an Entrepreneur magazine article about how you, because of UFC and other things that you're doing, because you're advertising with UFC and other things, your revenue spiked to $10 million. That's 2007, but that's as far as I could get. Where are you guys today?
About the same.
$10 million a year selling razors.
It's not bad.
Does it feel like it's not bad because it's about the same, because I compared it to 2007?
I mean, a lot of things happened in the razor industry and the blade industry, like we were talking previous, mm-hmm. in terms of how often people change their blades. In the years since, we've come out with different designs. So we had to take back older designs and push the newer models into the stores.
All right, let's talk about how you built this $10 million company. It started with you working at GeoCities, and you did this while you were working there, right?
Well, what happened was I moved down to Los Angeles in 97 because I'd worked in the internet computer software technology in Seattle. Moved down to LA, worked for Disney Imagineering for a while. Then I worked at GeoCities. And it was actually about the time that I moved to LA because I had been shaving since I was 22. When in 97 I had turned 30. So I had been shaving for 7 years, and really what it came down to me was trying to build a better mousetrap, because I would shave at night, and shaving with a regular conventional razor takes a long time. I wanted to shave in the morning. I didn't have the time. So I figured out people talk about the eureka moment, which is I was rubbing my head. And I thought, boy, if I could take a razor and put it on my finger and shave by feel, then it would be so much easier.
Todd, what's the problem, though, with shaving using a conventional razor? The same thing that has a stick that you shave your head with. If your head is carved or contoured. Contoured. What's the problem with just taking the same thing and going like this? I haven't shaved my head ever, so I don't know.
Okay, so the biggest problem that head shavers have would be shaving the back of your head or shaving places that you can't see. Mm-hmm. The other part would be, hey, if you and I were going to play pass with a ball, I would use my dominant hand. So when you shave, I mean, I don't know, you don't shave any place I can see, but if you shave something using a conventional razor, you'll use your dominant hand. Mm-hmm. So with your face, it's very easy to do it with one hand. With your head, you'd have to start working really strange angles.
Got it.
So if I asked you for money out of your pocket, you would use whichever hand is closer. So it's proprioception. It's knowing where your extremities are. So if you can touch your hand to your head, you can conceivably trust a blade there because you're guiding it with your fingertips.
I see. I do actually, I shave the back of my neck on a regular basis, and there I use the stick, and it's kind of a pain. I see what you mean. With the left hand, it's not as easy as the right.
Okay, so you use each hand. Do you look in a mirror, too?
I do. I hold up a mirror, and actually I was on vacation recently, and so the back of my neck got really furry because I didn't have a separate mirror, and I didn't want to go out of my way to look for one.
Right, and if you're looking in a mirror, everything's backwards.
Yeah.
So with the head blade, or the whole idea of head blade, is now I shave in the shower and it takes me 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it takes me longer to shave my face than it does my head.
So you had this problem, and you said, maybe other people do. Or did you? Did you check to see if you were the only one who had it?
No. Even when I lived in Seattle, I would ask guys with shaved heads. And it was in Seattle, it was funny because more and more guys were shaving their heads. And so you'd have this kind of, hey, I shave my head, how do you do it? And you get all these different, like, not home formulations, but what blades people use, how they shave. And it got to a point once when I went to a bar in Seattle, and any guy with a shaved head that walked in, they put a number on the back of his head, because that's way it's easy to tell who's who. And I realized, well, it's becoming more popular. It's not just me. It's, you know, eight other guys in this bar. When I moved down to L.A., it became where, if you think of the bell curve, I just happened to be at the beginning of that bell curve. And when I decided to have the idea, or I had that eureka moment, and I came up with my initial design, the thing that pushed it through was the perseverance, but it was also the fear that knowing maybe 5 years or 10 years down the road, when there's a lot more guys shaving their heads, and I didn't want to walk into a store, see a product that was essentially a head blade that I did not make, and think, I thought of that. You know, that's mine.
Yeah, sure, to see that someone else ran with that idea is so painful.
Yeah, I mean, people must have said that to you when you started your companies.
About interviewing, for some reason, nobody ever said, I wish I'd come up with that first.
Really? Until you cashed out?
Maybe they did, but I think that there have been times in my life where I felt that way, and it stinks, where I thought of something, and I didn't do it, and I see someone else doing it, and it hurts really badly, and I get what you're trying to avoid with that. But it's still a tough thing, though, to create a blade. I mean, it's not like software. It's not like an interview. I could create an interview using an iPad, an Android phone, a computer, anything to create an actual blade. Where did you make? How did you make your first prototype to see if it worked?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't. I wasn't the smartest guy in picking my profession. You know, it was definitely necessity was mother of all invention. And when I first came out with a head blade prototype, I would have to buy Gillette blades, and I have to put them. Actually, this is the museum. Like, if I didn't do this, I could do the prices right. But this is the essential, this is the original prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it's Michael Jordan's logo on it, because I call it the hair Jordan.
Okay. I see. It looks like a thin hockey puck with a razor attached to one end and two things on the other to hold it in place.
Yeah, people say it's like a joy buzzer.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
When you're a kid, so maybe that's where it came from.
Yep.
But I would not use it as a joy buzzer. So anyways, this was to show the concept works.
Okay.
And what I quickly realized was, I could not make things that looked like they weren't. I like to say, like, this looks like a dreidel, you know, like the dreidels you made at home.
Yep.
Or just like a little, you know, class project. So I started making more prototypes.
With that first version? It looks very simple. It has the blade on it, and you can hold it between your fingers. What's the problem with that?
And it's a basketball. What's the problem with that? I could only make one at a time. Now, the other problem is, because the blade is on the bottom, it's like a seesaw. So really, you have the blade, but the blade's not pivoting.
Ah, okay.
So that's how I created the suspension idea. So we go to a few months later, I made this prototype, which is, again, the Hair Jordan.
Okay.
And at this point, I was going to Home Depot and buying their, like, clamps.
Okay, that's what that is, just a clamp from Home Depot on the back?
Yeah, and then I would actually buy the old Gillette razor that had the slide-on bar.
Yep.
And I'd put that in. Because I got so mad about buying Gillette razors that I would actually rip them out of each prototype when I was done.
So you wouldn't keep paying for them.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Cash was tight. So then I had this bar, and this is from the old Track 2. And it became, this was a pivotal point in Headblade, because at that point, Gillette, I think, had come out with a Mach 3, and the sharper image, on their catalog, they had a thing called the DynaBlade, which was a vibrating handle. They had one that they made for the Mach 3, and then they had one that they made for the Gillette sensor. And I remember saying to my ex-wife, this is a lot of things, but I remember saying, how can they do that and not get sued, because they're infringing on Gillette patents? And then a week later in the Wall Street Journal was, Gillette then sued Sharper Image to take this razor off the market, because back then the whole proprietary thing with the blades, other than the blade configuration, was the attachment point, was the pivot. So this is the Gillette Track 2, and what I did early on was I realized that there was a company that made a little adapter so that their old metal handles would be able to snap on this adapter, and then in the Attra and the Attra Plus that pivot, there are little pivot holes. So you could then have a pivoting razor use old Gillette technology, but then this adapter. So essentially,
now it doesn't create the seesaw.
Yeah, it has this end here, so it is like a little suspension like a car.
Yes.
But what it did, ultimately, was it allowed me to make a razor that did not infringe on any patents. Because if Gillette was upset that I used this pivot, I didn't make this pivot back in 2000. I made a razor that had the slide-on bar that, if you took the old Gillette razor, it would slide on and be a non-pivoting razor.
And Todd, if someone wanted to buy your blade and use it right, would they have to buy the pivot in addition to the blade?
A head blade, when you buy a head blade, it comes standard with the body, the adapter, and one blade.
I see. And the adapter wasn't made by you. It was made by someone else who could get in trouble and sued by Gillette.
Early on, and now it's manufactured by us, correct.
Gotcha. And now is it legal to...
You are correct, sir.
By the way, I see all this. I'm a gadget guy. I'm really fat. Sorry, there's a little bit of a lag. That's why it seems like does it seem like we're talking on each other?
No, I just talk over people and I mutter. And that's one of the things my ex-wife used to say to me, but okay.
Speaking of your ex-wife, that's what I was going to ask you. I love this stuff. I would like to be in your office and check this out and see the thought process as you went from step to step. That's why I do these interviews. Your wife, when she saw you go through this, making blades at home, what did she think of that?
Not much.
She said, this is not going anywhere, or did she support it at all, or was she...
She works in the television industry, so it was more like I was the inventor. Mm-hmm. I was that cookie guy is in that other room. I don't know. I think there was an unfamiliarity with the concept of what I was trying to do, because a lot of people follow a career. And I think when you talk about an entrepreneur and you talk about the mindset and why we do certain things and whether you're driven by money or passion, whatever it is, it comes from the heart. It comes where you have this belief in yourself and you're willing to take chances and you're willing to take risks and persevere. And you know that I'm putting myself out there and some people are going to love what I do. Some people are going to hate what I do. Some people are going to be jealous. Some people are going to be... It's all those things. But that's what really, I think, when you become an entrepreneur, you accept all those.
Here's what I heard. You accept it from the world. But I would imagine, tell me if this is too personal, I will back away. But you expect it from the world. You don't expect it inside the house. I will. But there was one time you were going to buy a suit. What did your wife say when she heard you were going to buy a suit?
Oh, well, actually, I bought the suits. I put them in the bedroom. She came home from work, and I said, don't go into the bedroom because I have all the... And this is when I was working out of my apartment because, like any good startup back then, we had a two-bedroom apartment, and one bedroom was my office. And I bought some nice suits from Fred Segal's, and I was kind of mixing and matching them, and I had them on the bed. And she came in, and I said, don't go in the second bedroom because I'm just setting all my suits up. And she said, what are you doing today? You go from that room to that room.
What do you need a suit for?
Think of it like when I go pick up your dry cleaning, at least I'll look nice, you know?
So that's got to hurt, didn't it?
I really don't know. I guess I'm that careless individual.
Here's the thing. I used to live in L.A. I used to see these guys with big dreams, and you know they weren't going anywhere. And I used to say to myself, am I like that? Am I that guy who has this big dream and he clearly isn't going anywhere? Did you ever have those doubts?
About myself?
Yes. As you were building this, going through prototype after prototype.
Well, I definitely had when I spent $150,000, right? So I got some money from my father, my own money, and then two friends. Mm-hmm. And I remember that the first day that we were going to sell head blades, it was at, so you know Venice Beach, right? Mm-hmm. So I rented a booth at Venice Beach. I'd spent 8 months, I think, developing the head blade. And the night before I rented the booth at the beach, I had friends come over because we had to hand package the head blades. They were actually made in L.A. So I actually had the molds. I had them produced in L.A. And my friends had to help me package them. And so I had 500 head blades. And I had one friend that was, there was a wire that would hold the head blade down on the box. My friend was left-handed and he was doing it backwards. And I said, well, you know, those we could sell in Australia, or you can redo them all so they're all consistent, because I don't want it to look like this is a home craft thing. This is a production line. So the next day I went to Venice. I had 500 head blades. I had two girls on rollerblades. My ex-wife was there. I had a couple friends helping me sell head blades. And it was really, it was breaking me down, because after that day, it was a nice, beautiful summer day, and people would say, oh, it's so great, why haven't I seen it on TV, or why haven't I seen it in magazines? And I'd say, today's our big day. Today is the grand opening or release of Headblade. And so out of the 500, we sold 8. And I remember saying to my ex-wife, why am I doing this? I mean, I spent all this money to make the molds, to make the prototypes, to make the products, to get here, to have 500 head blades. And at the end of the day, we sold 8. And she said, you have to look at the bright side. I said, what could be the bright side? She said, well, you sold 5 and everybody else sold 3 combined. And I looked at her, I go, what am I, employee of the month? And it was like, I don't know, a year later, that, you know, the cartoon Non Sequitur?
Uh-huh.
And it was a one single cell frame, and it was a picture of a guy at this long desk, and in the front it said the benefits of being self-employed. And behind his desk were all these framed photos of employee of the month, and the picture was him. So I think for the first, you know, year and a half, it definitely was a struggle. And I would package every single head blade. I'd walk it down to the post office. They knew me at the post office, so that they let me go in the back door so I didn't have to stand in line. And at the end of the first year, I bought them all yellow and black watches, because it was kind of a milestone.
Wow.
But it to me, it was the dream of taking an idea and a concept to a product and then putting it in production and getting it to the market. I mean, in and of itself, you've crossed a lot of obstacles that a lot of people don't.
And the reason you were able to take so many orders into the post office is it because you started to sell the blades online and that was a big turning point?
That was what got me on the map. But back in 1999, there weren't a lot of people that were buying stuff online. There was still the concept of, oh, I don't want to put my credit card online, yep, because then everybody will have it. I mean, you probably had that too, right?
I think... Yeah, I don't want to put that. I don't even remember. I was on there at the time, and I don't remember people feeling that way. I remember being comfortable putting credit cards online at any moment, and it felt odd to me that people weren't. But the majority of the world wasn't ready for it.
Oh, totally. That was where you got the early adopters. And I remember there were articles saying, you know, a couple of years later, it's more risky to give a waiter your credit,
yes,
card and have them walk to the kitchen and disappear with it and bring it back than it is to put your credit card online.
I remember that.
Target never said that. But anyway, so it's one of those things that early on, it was early adopters, and then the magazines. Like, I would send press kits to all the magazines, and they refused to write about it because they considered Headblade .com. And I kept saying, it's not a .com. It's a product-related company that sells products online. So essentially, I had to walk from my apartment to Fred Siegel's. You know Fred Siegel?
Yep. The shirt that sells, like, $400 T-shirts.
Yeah, where I bought my nice suits.
Yes.
And that must have been really a day nice off. I walked down there. But I got them to carry the head blade. And from there, all the magazines would write about it. You know, as long as I could say available at Fred Siegel or headblade.com, to them it was a legitimate product. And I think that's what happens when you're an entrepreneur and you get all these roadblocks from people that don't understand your concept. And I remember when I was in college, I went to Bowdoin College in Maine. And one of my professors said, when you're painting a painting, people are going to critique it, and they're going to give you their insight and their thoughts. But the real thing is, nobody knows what's inside your head. Nobody knows what that painting's going to look like until it's done. That would be the time for them to be able to chime in. And I faced that a lot with Headblade. If you told somebody about the concept, or if you told somebody what you're trying to do, they couldn't conceive of it. And it was like, that's why I'm doing it, not them.
Yes.
And then when it's done, then, okay, here it is. Now tell me.
I mean, me do a quick plug for my sponsor, and then I'm looking at an article from 2000 that I want to ask you about. The plug is for andrewswelcomegate.com. If you've been to Mixergy.com, you've seen that I have a page that explains what Mixergy is and then asks you to register or to give an email address if you want to join. That page has done phenomenally for me, mostly because, frankly, when people come to the site, they don't want to see the latest interview. They want to understand, what is this about? So I took that page and I turned it into a template with the help of the people over at leadpages.net, and now it's available to you. If you go to andrewswelcomegate.com, you can get that page, put it up on your site, and start turning hits to your site. Get them to turn from hits to leads so that you can collect email addresses. andrewswelcomegate.com. Here's what the article says. It's from March 2000, really soon after you started. You debuted for sale last June on a website that you built yourself, drummed up interest for your $15 item by posting messages on web bulletin boards, and catered to target customers, which included balding men, hardcore athletes, members of the military, and aspiring bohemians. In the first week, it says, green tallied sales of $300. These days, weekly receipts average $3,000. And you expect to lose $173,000 that year on sales of $1.6 million in the year 2000. How did that – is that essentially capturing what the year 2000 was like for you?
No.
What happened really?
What happened really, and this is the brilliant thing about this article. Like, I love that the article came out, and they were basing a lot on the business plan that I had somebody write. And, you know, business plans are not reality. And the best part was Victor Khayyam. Mm-hmm. Did you see his quote in that?
No, let me see that.
He's going to quote something like, I don't know how the article got through the editors, in that looking at the business plan, and Victor Khayyam's like, okay, if he's going to do, let's say, $6 million, whatever that number was, he's one guy in an apartment. He should probably hire an employee. You know what I mean? Like, it just, the numbers didn't make sense. So, like, I told them what the actual thing was, but they said, do you have a business plan? I said, okay, here's a business plan. And I never raised the money because I started with just kind of friends and family and my own money.
And that total was $150,000.
Yeah, so it was
so
a great
article. I don't see that the Victor Khayyam part didn't make it into the online version of this article, but I see you're saying not only did they buy this business plan and take it as if it was really happening, but even Victor Khayyam reacted to the projection as opposed to the reality.
Well, no, I think Victor Khayyam, he read the business plan, and then he also read my interview, and he kind of put one and one together and said, this is the business plan, this is reality.
Where he is saying he should hire an employee as a way of saying, well, something doesn't seem right here.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Did you actually get $3,000 in weekly receipts around that time? Did you start to get sales from bulletin boards?
Yeah. I mean, we got the magazine hits. It was amazing because I had the 1-800 number that went to my apartment, and I remember taking calls in the middle of the night and writing down credit card numbers and orders. Wow. So I'd wake up the next morning and I would have this written down. I wouldn't remember answering the phone. But we did like $30,000 one month, I think, when we were in Playboy or Details magazine. But it was really funny because people would call and be late at night. They'd wake me up. They'd say, well, did I wake you up? And I said, no, we work 24/7 here. Like, I'm on the night shift. And one day the phone rang, and I picked it up. And I realized when I picked it up, I don't think it was 800 number that dialed. And you know, like in Santa Monica, there's a lot of, like, the front keypad gates of the building ring to your phone.
Yep.
So I answered the phone. I'm like, Headblade. And I heard, hi, it's Stefan from Germany. I'm downstairs. I was like, what? Apparently this guy had ordered from me in Germany, didn't get his order, was on vacation in L.A., so he came to the Headblade headquarters, which was my rental apartment on 6th and Montana. So I think when he came to the door, he thought it was a scam. But then when he came up and saw me dressed in my Fred Siegel suit and the whole closet of inventory, we got them all set up.
Another call that came in around the year 2000 was from Time Magazine. They reached you on that 800 number on your website?
Yeah.
What did they want?
Well, that was a great story because, again, there were some immediate family members who I was living with, one person, who said, don't answer the phone. It's Thanksgiving. You know, my family's in town. Just stop and not concentrate on Headblade. Don't answer the phone. So I pick up the phone, and it's Time Magazine. I'm like, it's Time Magazine. You know, I want to answer that call. And they said, we're just calling to confirm some information. We can't tell you why we're calling, but you'll be very happy that we called. Already I was ecstatic, but then a month or 2 months later when it came out and Time Magazine is one of the top 10 designs in the world, and that's the thing. It's another feather or accolade, and what makes me so honored by those are ones that money can't buy. You know, Gillette can spend billions of dollars on advertising. They can buy so many different awards, but you can't buy yourself into the Museum of Modern Art. You can't buy yourself into Time Magazine. So it really became just something that filled my heart.
Time Magazine doesn't sell Blades directly, does it? Not like being in Playboy, but it does add to the business, right?
It adds legitimacy and validity. So when people say, why don't I see it in magazine? You say, well, you're reading the wrong magazine. You should probably read something a little higher than, you know, Jugs. You should be right up there and read Time, right? Oh, can I say that?
Yeah, you can say anything you want. I see. And so it just gives you a lot of credibility to have been in that magazine.
Yeah, and also personally, like people, like I'll lecture at Pepperdine at the graduate school and people say, what does success mean to you? Or how much money do you have to be successful or to feel like? And for me, it goes back to that Paulo Coelho. I know I always say his name wrong, but do you know the guy that wrote The Alchemist?
Yep.
Also wrote the one-page story called Dream. And it's about the three guys working in the hot summer sun in the quarry. And somebody says, the first guy, what are you doing? And he's got the axe, and he says, I'm breaking rocks. He said, okay. So they go to the second guy, what are you doing? And the second guy said, I'm working. I come here in the morning, they tell me what to do, and then at 5 o'clock I go home. And then they said, the third guy who was just had the axe, and he was just working away furiously, and they said to him, what are you doing? And he said, I'm building a cathedral. So there's that old saying, count no man fortunate until he's dead. It's, I want to have passion in what I do, and Headblade gives me that passion. You know, when I worked at Starwave doing the ESPN thing, I was a character with the daily blog. There's certain things that, it's not about the money, it's about the passion and what drives you. Mm-hmm. And if I died today, then I've had a great life, you know, and I'm doing what I love to do. So for me, the success thing is about following your dreams.
And this is, it's more than just shaving, it's art. In fact, when I talked to Anne Marie, who works here at Mixergy, and I said, I'm interviewing you, she said, oh yeah, the guy whose razors look kind of like a truck, the ones with the wheels, that came in 2006.
Right.
How do you add that kind of design touch to something that looks like, or anyone else would say, just should look like a razor?
Well, I definitely, when I was a kid, I loved cars. I've always loved cars. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote Lee Iacocca when I was like 12 years old, and I found a letter that he wrote me back. Mm-hmm. Probably somebody wrote me back. But I love cars and I love design. And it's great that it afforded me, when I came up with the idea of Headblade, and maybe that's how I came up with the idea, was something that fit on your finger that you drive like a car. So people do say, oh, it looks like a Hot Wheel. And over the years, like, this is the original one that's in the Museum of Modern Art.
Yep.
And you'll notice it does not have wheels. And it does not have wheels because purely I could not afford wheels because it meant another mold, it meant another
But you were thinking of wheels even as far back as then.
Yeah, because that's a whole suspension idea. And it's funny because with the original, if somebody used it and did not like it, it was because they were using it like this or they were using it backwards and they didn't know to put this pad down.
Got it.
So when I came up with the next design, this one is essentially the same thing, but it has the wheels. So anybody that puts it on their head realizes, oh, I got to drive this like a car.
The wheel has to go on the head.
Yeah, and then a little later, and this one, I came up with the idea, this is just the evolution of head blade, right? All the same concept. The newest one diverges from that concept. But this one is essentially like the other one, has the wheels, has a triple blade, but it has a little rubber fingering.
Mm-hmm.
And this is based on when I saw the kids' little sippy cups that had the plastic and rubber, or toothbrushes that are all molded together. So this allows you to just put your finger in and the ring will adjust automatically. So what I learned from this, and this is 10 years in the making, so it went from the original concepts in 98, 99 to 2005, and then I changed the finger ring. And then in 2012, we came up with the all-new head blade, and this one is radically different.
Okay, it's like reverse. The wheel's on the front, the blade on the back.
Yeah. Yeah, so this one, it's reversed for a couple of reasons. One is, this is new blade technology, so it has the flow-through design, and you can have a four-blade or a six-blade. And what we realized over the years, there's a learning curve with head blade. Because any other conventional razor, you pull, you don't push. With the head blade, the blade goes first. So if I was going to shave, I'd shave this way, or I'd shave this way. Either way, the blade is in the front. Which, for some people that aren't used to that or don't get over the learning curve, it's not the
They're used to the stick part of it. How do you know this? Do you watch people as they shave?
Like, do I set up webcams in public restrooms and I'm going to get
whatever. I don't think that's that out of line. I think I'm curious about how people watch my programs, how they download it. It's interesting to watch them do it. Do you watch them? Do you go in? Do you have a team of people who do this?
No.
No. So how do you know that people don't get it the way that you meant for them to understand how to shave with your blades?
Well, early on, it was just definitely user comments and because of the forums. You know, people will write you if they don't like something. People will write you if they love something.
So you went onto the forums. You said, here's what I created for you guys. And you were, how did you sell in the forums in a way that gave you, that got you feedback?
Well, we didn't get the feedback in the forums from just posting in the forums. You would get the feedback in the forums from people that saw the razor, that went and bought the razor, and then went to the forums.
I see.
So now we have, through Facebook and our other social media, we have like 500 headbladers who are our test bladers. So when we went from this design, right, this is the Headblade Sport, which is the evolution of the headblade.
Mm-hmm.
Right, same concept, just added wheels and then went up to a three-blade design. To this one, this took 3 years or 4 years to make. And it afforded us the ability to, like I talked earlier about our adapters,
mm-hmm.
It's a mix and match scenario. So if you had this old head blade, when we were actually testing blades, we would send them adapters and blades that then they would snap on to their head blade.
I see.
So you could use, and what we did was, this is how the new blades look on the head blade sport. So this one you would still push, not pull. And what we would do is we'd send these out to the 500 guys and we'd have them take online surveys. And then we got it to the point where over 70% gave it a shave rating of 88 or higher on a scale of 1 to 10. Then we actually disclosed to all the guys that really we've designed an all-new head blade. And the all-new head blade is the ATX. So now, we kind of have two schools. We kind of have the taste great, less filling. We have guys that love the original design, the head blade or the head blade sport, and then people that love the ATX. The ATX was developed because there's no learning curve, has better blades, and then as a result, you can now shave your face or your body with it.
I see. And that's why it's interesting to see how you got to that, too, that you sent it out to people who were users and testers, and you got feedback from them through surveys, and you adjusted based on that, and you understood that you got something when the feedback was so strong.
Yeah, no, we changed a lot over the years, and we continually try to improve our products because, as I said before, you know, Headblade, when I started Headblade, there were no other products for head shavers. And if you look at, like, the clipper companies and you look at skincare, people understand skincare. People understand hair care. We're head care. So we're that little niche category in the middle that kind of bridges both together. And early on when I was selling Headblades, and we got into Rite Aid in like 2002, clippers were sold in the hair care. And now they're sold next to razors. And you can also look at, there was a clear delineation between what a wet razor was and what a dry shaver was.
Right.
What an electric razor was and what a non-electric razor is.
Yep.
Now it's just all one.
Let me see how you grew this. So, beginning, it's you sending out press kits to magazines, waiting for the hit, walking into Fred Siegel, pushing them to try selling it, going online, creating a web page you create yourself, and then going into the forums and message boards online and encouraging people to try this out. It's a lot of that. The next step up, where you say, I can't keep doing this on my own, what's the next step up for getting new customers?
If you look at their Mintel reports, there's other research, you know, guys are huge on free trial and word of mouth.
Okay.
So those were some of the keys, but still, you know.
So then you did Blade of the Month Club early on?
We did User of the Month.
What's User of the Month?
People would send us, like, my favorite, Headblade has afforded me the ability to meet a lot of people I never would have met or interacted. You know, if you look at, I like to say Headblade is like the Benetton of razors, because it's almost every different demographic that you would never put in the same room. You know, if you look at early on head shavers, there were all these groups that there were stigmatism, or there was just, wasn't mainstream, let's say. You know, the military didn't approve head shaving until 2003 or 2004. And I used to have people that say, I'd love to shave my head, but I can't because I'm a doctor or I'm a lawyer. And to me, that was so foreign because there was such a stigma on shaving your head. And, you know, we do stuff with cancer organizations, alopecia organizations.
Forgive me, Todd, but what I'm trying to get at is I want to learn how you grew your business to $10 million so that the person who's listening to us can use more of your ideas, because I think that you push things where most people would be too chicken to go. You walk into the store and are promoting it. You stand on Venice Beach where most people would be too chicken to stand by their own products. What's the next thing that you did that got more customers so that someone in my audience who says, I'm ready to go big, I'm ready to go like Todd, can learn from and then go use it themselves?
I think there's a combination of the guerrilla marketing we did, the social media we did. We had a huge MySpace page, which is now gone.
MySpace page helped.
Yeah, MySpace, and then, you know, everything went over to Facebook. Like, we've redone our website, but really it's just building customers and building traffic.
How did you build traffic?
Really, free press. There are a lot of famous people over the years that have had Headblades. That, like, Howie Mandel bought his at Fred Siegel. He's been a Headblader for that long. And Chris Daughtry was using Headblade before he was on.
How do you find out when they do that? It's not like shoes where you can see them wearing it in a magazine and then go promote
it. That is one of the trickiest things, because we get invited to do a lot of gift lounges and, you know, where you can take a picture of a famous person holding your product. And I don't believe in that, because I think everything, like, I'll give you an example. The golfer, the famous golfer shaves his head, but he wasn't shaving his head before. Mm-hmm. Through a friend, I sent him a Headblade, and then he actually, in a PGA interview, because he'd started shaving his head, he said, well, I started shaving it because this company, Headblade, sent me a razor, and I realized, you know, I had already talked to my wife about how I looked, and it didn't look great, and so I started using Headblade. So those are the kind, because you don't see somebody who uses Headblade, because unless they're wearing Headblade apparel, you just don't know.
See that they shave their heads or talk about it somewhere, and boom, you send them a sample.
Yeah, you're gonna be on top of that, but we're not trying to exploit. We're just,
of course, you know, that's a nice thing to do.
In a way that we want to send it to people that we earnestly think want Headblade or need Headblade or should have Headblade.
I think that's fascinating. Do you have another idea like that that's worked for you?
Well, I'll tell you one story which is kind of funny, which happened early on. The New York Yankees, there's a guy called Bald Vinny, and Vinny does the roll call. Have you ever been to Yankee Stadium?
Oh, yeah.
So When I first started Headblade, this guy Vinny wrote me and said, "I love Headblade, blah blah, I'm coming out to LA." And I said, "Oh, you can. This is how like you go that extra mile." I said, "Oh, you can stay with my wife and I." So Vinny came out and he told me he does a roll call. Like in the beginning of the game, he's the guy that yells out every single player, and the player turns and he bows, and it's kind of an institution, right? The bleacher creatures. So Vinny came out, stayed with me. We went to a UFC fight in Vegas, and then Vinny bought the printing press that he later used to sell T-shirts outside Yankee Stadium. And Vinny said to me, "You know, I hold the flag during the seventh inning. And when the guy comes out and the opera singer comes out and does the seventh, they show that flag." And I said, "Oh, that's interesting, Vinny." So anyways, that year, the Yankees were in the World Series with the Marlins. And I remember my ex-wife and I were at P.F. Chang, and they were showing the game. And then seventh inning stretch, the guy comes on, they show the flag, and I'm like, "That's Vinny. I can actually tell that's Vinny." So I called Vinny up and I said, "Hey, if I overnight you a Headblade banner, will you hold the banner up next to the flag?" And he said, "Sure, send it to me." So I sent it to him. The next World Series game, they show the singer, they show the flag, and Vinny, his friend was holding the flag because Vinny was holding the banner.
Oh, wow.
And I got so many calls and so many emails about that. And some people were upset with me. They're like, "How could you do that? You know, it's the seventh inning stretch, blah, blah." And I'm like, if you look at the TV, the Fox logo is giant in the corner. It's not like I'm doing anything really bad. But then it was funny because I got a call from ESPN. And I thought, "Oh, I'm in trouble now." And they said, "Hey, we just want to see if you want to advertise." And I'm like, "Well, if I had the money to advertise on ESPN, I wouldn't have Vinny holding the banner up. So
you did eventually start sponsoring UFC, right?
Yeah.
Did that work out for you?
Yeah, that was great. The first guy we sponsored, I think, was Frank Trigg. I became friends with a lot of the guys. We sponsored Chuck Liddell when he was still in Japan, Rampage Jackson. We probably sponsored maybe 50 fighters, 50 or 60. And then we did stuff directly with the UFC. And that was one of those where, again, it was like the bell curve thing. You know, when UFC first started, I talked to Dana White. I knew it was a great sport that was going to get a lot of viewers. And it was like the major league of fighting, but you could get it for so much less than any other major league sport. So I did that until we couldn't afford that. And then we did the IFL, which was on the UPNs, the My13s. And now we do stuff with Glory World Series, which is kickboxing. And they're on Spike. So really, I remember an article I read from the guy that started GoDaddy. You know, you'll never run out of opportunities to spend money. So if you have money and you want to advertise, when people come to you, you're in a much better bargaining position, and you can really pick and choose. So we always kind of look for that needle in the haystack, which would essentially be anything that hits three demographics. You know, if it's something that's MMA that would hit military guys, security guards, fighting guys. So there's all these things of where is there a high concentration of head shavers, because it has to come from multiple groups.
And so you started out by sponsoring individuals. Was that expensive?
No, individuals is always less expensive than working directly with an organization. Mm-hmm. But it has its own caveats, because if you sponsor a fighter, you have to figure out whether the fighter fights standing up or fights on his back, and what style they fight in. Because we sponsored guys that have won in 20 seconds, and we sponsored guys that have lost in 20 seconds. So you can pay a lot of money for no visibility, you know, and at least if...
Oh, I see. If he fights on his back, you can't see the logo.
Depending where your logo is.
Got it.
So I have a couple guys that work here that are really into MMA, and when we get pitched by the managers, I send them off to, you know, my two guys and say, figure out if there's a deal to be had, find out which leg panel we'd want to be on, whether it's a right leg, left leg, back, or front or side, and then you'd get on their banner, maybe on their T-shirt. But it's definitely, you know, if 10 guys come to you asking for sponsorship, you can kind of whittle it down, and you can kind of figure out. You'll see a lot of companies in MMA that'll have a huge exposure for one fight or two fights, and then they're gone. You never see that company again. And it's because they've completely given all their wads of cash for entry into the MMA, and they didn't get any return, and they didn't come back.
And so you spent it on individuals. You made sure that you'd be visible. How much money is one person did one person go for back then?
It could be anywhere from product trade, $100 to $5,000.
Oh, wow.
It is the Wild West. It is the Wild West.
It does have a high perceived value, though, if you're in MMA, you're right there on the stage, on the guy. I should say for people in the international audience, MMA is mixed martial arts and UFC is Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Oh, and it's in a lot of places overseas, it's huge, as big or bigger than, like, in Thailand, it's huge. I was just in the Philippines this week and they had a fight. You see it all around. So it's definitely a worldwide sport. Even Glory World Series, a lot of Russian, Brazilian, European fighters.
Are you a millionaire at this point, like cash in the bank, not value the company?
I would say no, but value, it's one of those, I don't really count those things. You would laugh at how I live. I live like a pauper.
Even to this day?
Yeah, I live in a 400 square foot studio.
Really? That's tiny. That's like my office here.
On the beach in Santa Monica. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's not including the bathroom, I don't think. I don't really measure the bathroom.
Why don't you live better? You're in a place where if you live better, you get a lot of rewards. People love you more.
I'm not an immigrant to be loved. I mean, I had a house that I had designed down on the beach in Santa Monica, down in, you know where Patrick's Roadhouse is?
Mm-mm.
In Santa Monica Canyon. I had a house, designed a house, had a wife, and I remember... Remember the Talking Heads song? Do you remember the Talking Heads?
Yeah.
You know the song, Once in a Lifetime?
Nope.
That's not my beautiful house. That's not my beautiful
wife.
Oh,
yeah. This is not my beautiful house.
I'm more happy now.
Really?
Singing that song, living in a 400-square-foot studio. Because I'm the man that owns little is little owned. And that's how I live my life. If I buy something, I give something.
You get to take a nice salary, at least from the company now? Are you doing?
Yeah.
You are. You're taking more than $100,000 salary a year.
Yeah.
I'm worried about you.
Don't worry about me. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like last week. I went to China. I went to Hong Kong.
I see.
And then I took my employee who works with the factories but has never been over to the factories because we work direct with the factories. I flew him over. He had never been to Asia before. His ex-wife is from Manila. He had never been in Manila. And so I said, okay, for the weekend, let's stop in Manila. Right? Because for him, it's an amazing experience for whatever he does after Headblade, that he has all this experience now visiting a factory, working with the factories, and as a side gig or as a side gift, we got to go to a place that he's probably always wanted to go. And he hung out with his ex-wife's brother. So that's what makes me happy, is I'm in a nice position. I don't want a big house. I don't want a house. I like when I lock my door. I don't have to worry about where I live. I don't have to worry about my possessions.
Yeah, April, in the pre-interview, asked you what advice you have for other entrepreneurs, and you said, use every resource you have and don't buy nice cars or expensive office equipment. Don't get carried away.
Yeah, wait till everybody else goes out of business and just buy their crap. I'll show you. This is my hero. This is my dad. See?
Yeah.
I can be anything.
Oh, you got to bring that closer. Let me take a look.
Oh, yeah. He's a good-looking guy.
Cool. Where is he now?
What? Oh, he's still alive.
Yeah, where? Is he in California, too?
He's in Maine. He never leaves Maine. He doesn't like to go in anybody else's bathrooms.
I was like that in high school. I had to keep rushing home.
Yeah, that's how my family is. They're all in Maine.
Are you dating now? You're the head of a well-known company, doing very well. Los Angeles is a great place to date. Are you getting to go out?
I don't go out a lot.
You don't?
No. I'm kind of a homebody. I love to cook. I love to travel. And if I do date, she has to be small because the apartment's small. You date?
Sorry?
This is your life. I was on, one of those shows that I was on that I loved was To Tell the Truth. Do you remember that show?
Yeah.
I watched that show when I was a kid, and I loved it. And I remember reading that they had a casting call about 10 years ago for the one that John Hurley, was going to host.
Okay.
John Lombardi.
Okay.
The guy from Seinfeld. Jay Peterman from Seinfeld.
Anyways,
I wrote them and I said, I want to be the guy. I don't want to be one of the fake guys. I want to be the real guy. And they actually did it. And it was one of those, like, full circle of life kind of things.
And you were on This Is Your Life.
No, I was on To Tell the Truth.
To Tell the Truth, excuse me.
Remember that? They say, with the real Todd Green, please stand up. And everybody makes believe they're going to stand up. So I was on this show.
You know what? I do vaguely remember that show from back then. I guess we're a few years apart.
We are. We're 7 years. Well, Google it. Google it. It's fun.
I'm Googling him. I see John Hurley here.
Yeah, Google To Tell the Truth.
To Tell the Truth.
Headline To Tell the Truth. It's me with two African-American guys. And they either, everybody thought it wasn't me or I was the ringer.
Did they reveal anything about you? I see it here, yes.
They all had a guess.
There it is. Headblade inventor Tom Green sits in with two impersonators on the show To Tell the Truth, hosted by John. Wow.
Yeah.
We've really gone, I've allowed this interview to go so far off like topic because I'm fascinated by you. There's something about you. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the fact that you
built this. It's glasses, right?
It looks like you're having a fun time. Yeah. And
look,
I think it's the product.
Look at the seat I got.
Yeah. Nobody had a seat like that in the shot. Are you pissed that I am...
I have to get it back, though. I'm just renting it for the day.
It's a poster. Are you pissed that there's still guys like me out there?
Say that again.
Are you the real Todd Green, actually, or did I just get... Let me see the video and see if I've got the right one.
There's three Todd Greens.
So before the interview, actually, you said that I donate my money to the barbershop.
Of your choice.
To the barbershop of my choice. I get that. That's the part. So does that bother you that people are still going in and doing things like that, spending money on a haircut month after month, week after week, that they don't like?
I don't know. I think they're. If you look at barbershops and like the movie barbershops for a lot of different cultures, it's kind of like the social place to hang out. And that's why you had the resurgence of, you know, the old fashioned barbershops because everybody wants that nostalgia.
No, I have to tell you, I hate the barbershop. I will do it and I'll wait too long. Even though I'm on camera, I should get a haircut. I wait too long. For a while there, I was doing clippers in the beginning of the Mixergy. It was so helpful to just go in the shower and just do it, clean it up and be done.
Do you do your beard too?
I use clippers on the beard too. That's a fairly new thing for me.
Perfect beard. You remind me of when I was a kid, the G.I. Joe that had the beard.
Did they? That yeah, that's the kind of look that I'm going for. That little, not 5 o'clock stubble, but like 9 o'clock stubble.
Yeah, it's very manly. It doesn't bother me that people do that. You know, at a certain point, they have to make a decision. You know, I remember, when I was in college, and I would go get my hair cut, and I remember the lady kind of freaked out because she said, "How do you want me to cut your hair?" And my hair was short, and I said, I don't want my ears to show. Because my brother always says I look like a car with the doors open.
Okay.
You get that? And then when I shaved my head, some guy said, "Oh, you don't look like a car with its doors open." And I said, "Oh, thank you. I'm so appreciative." He says, "No, with your head messed up like that, you look like a convertible."
Oh.
Doors open. But anyways, I remember when she was cutting my hair, and I would get it cut shorter and shorter on the top. But remember when, you don't remember the 80s, but when halogen lights first came out,
yes.
Anybody that was losing their hair, if you went into a nice restaurant with a bathroom and the light just shines right on, and also, I can't tell if your hair is thin up top. I won't even bring that up.
No, but you can bring it all up here. My hair is not thin on top. It is graying though. It's a pain in the butt.
You got the Obama gray. So, anyways, it would come straight down, and I was losing my hair on top.
Yes.
And she actually gave me Rogaine. My hairdresser. And I said, "You're only doing that because you don't want to lose a customer." Because that's what they're all afraid of. But I realized I had to do something, you know. And back then in the 80s, it was transplant, toupee, Rogaine.
I'm so glad those aren't the options anymore. Now it is shave your head. I've got a cousin who shaves his head. He looks great. He looks like he did 20 years ago because you can't tell if you take care of yourself. No one can tell otherwise.
If Gandhi was alive today, he'd be like, you know, a sexy rock star.
He would get Headblade in the mail.
Yeah,
maybe a banner for the next march. The website is headblade.com. It's so good to have you on here. Congratulations about your success. I've been looking forward to interviewing you for a long time because the story is just so interesting.
Thank you.
And the product is beautiful. I don't know if we could do it justice, frankly, guys in the audience, just by holding it up to the camera. Take a look at headblade.com and you'll see it for yourself.
Here's a logo, just so you know, because that's always been very, very important, is the branding.
Yes.
And this is based on the yin yang. You know, it's kind of like...
Ah, I see it, yes.
If Nike didn't already have the Just Do It, this is the idea of taking something that's very, very passive in your life, which would be hair loss. And once you shave your head, you're no longer losing your hair. So it's creating a positive out of a negative. This is a coaster.
But who did the logo? Sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, I did it with one other guy. There was a guy that wrote me first year on that said, I love Headblade, but I hate your logo, which was just HB, which in LA means Huntington Beach. You know, in products it means Hamilton Beach. There's so many HBs. So I said, well, I don't have a logo. And he said, well, let's work on a logo. And I said, well, what I'm looking for is yin yang, Michael Jordan, but not Michael Jordan. And it's actually, the funny part is, it is my face.
Oh, really?
And you see, I can't afford to pin my ears. Well, now I can, but I did it in the logo. So that's what I would look like. If I ever go
get you pinned your ears, that's what the site would look like.
I say, I want to look like this guy.
Oh, you know what? I'm now in the Internet Archive. I see the blade looks beautiful back in 2000, August 16th, 2000. The logo does look like the Huntington Beach the HB that people see on cars in L.A.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. I see it. All right.
Yeah. I'd love to take credit for inventing a beach.
Your designs are beautiful.
Thank
you all for being a part of it. Check out headblade.com and you'll see what we've been talking about. And there's also a really nice timeline that shows the progress of the company. I've been using that to follow along in this interview. Thank you, Todd. Thank you all. Bye, guys.
Thank you, Andrew.